Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. Mr. Wells Dixon from South Carolina, King Street. Glad to have you here, and you get to go first. Yes, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor, Judge Traxler, Judge King, Judge Hamilton. It appears to me that in the facts of this case, they're really not in dispute. And I guess I also should admit up front that unlike Mr. Williams, and even after two trials, I still don't have a plausible explanation as to how my client's passport got in the secret compartment in the vehicle along with the heroin. The appeal raises three issues. Issue two attributes error to the district court when it classified the defendant as a career offender and sentenced accordingly. Issue three attributes error to the defendant, when it denied the defendant's motion for a sentence which varied from the guideline range. In my opinion, these two issues have been fully briefed by the appellant and by the government in their respective briefs, and it is my intention to not spend any time, further time, on these two issues unless called upon to do so.
Let me ask you about your issue three. The sentence was within the guideline range, was it not?
Correct, Your Honor.
And there's no doubt the district court understood it had the authority to vary the sentence.
That's correct.
So is that issue reviewable on appeal?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right. The district court, I believe, is correct when it applied Jones to the facts of this Richard case. I believe it's also correct that there are no applicable exceptions to the application of the exclusionary rule in the Richard case. I think the court is in error when it determines that there is an intervening circumstance, a traffic violation, that this new and distinct crime purged the taint from the illegal use of the GPS tracking device, and that evidence subsequently seized was not suppressed. The district court did not specifically address the fact that the traffic stop was all part of the continued use of the GPS tracking device.
Was all part of what?
The continued use of the GPS tracking device. Installation of the tracking device on Norrell Rich's vehicle without a warrant, and its use to monitor the vehicle's movements for the purpose of obtaining information for a period of 27 days, constituted a search under Jones, and a seizure as determined also in Jones, and violated the protection provided by the Fourth Amendment. The only meaningful remedy, in the opinion of the appellant, is to exclude all evidence obtained as a result of this warrantless intrusion into Mr. Richard's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, the appellant understands that the issue of whether the exclusionary rule should apply in this situation is acknowledged as separate from the issue of whether Fourth Amendment rights were violated. However, the district court erred when it determined that the minor traffic offense committed by the driver of the vehicle, in which Mr. Richard was a passenger, constituted a new and distinct crime that purged the taint from the government's illegal use of the GPS tracking device.
What was it, a failure to give a turn signal?
He failed to give a turn signal on I-26 at 5:30 in the morning and moved into the exit lane. There's no question.
Moved into the exit lane.
Going
to get off of.
Yes, sir.
When they're coming into Charleston.
Coming into North Charleston, the Ashley Phosphate exit. That's one of the first major exits in North Charleston.
Okay.
All right. Let's see. Of course, the court cited Sprinkle as the authority for that Fourth Circuit opinion. But as addressed in Gaines, just in 2005, 2012, If the court looks to the connection between the illegal search and the seizure of the evidence for Richard's vehicle, it should determine that the causal connection between the illegal search and the seizure of the incriminating evidence is not so attenuated as to dissipate the taint of the illegal use of the GPS tracking device. First, the illegal search continued from the time the tracking device was attached to Richard's vehicle up to the time of the traffic stop. The use of the drug dog, the question of Richard and the driver, and the on-the-scene search of the vehicle and seizure of the heroin. The information obtained by the illegal use of the GPS tracking device, as monitored by the North Charleston Narcotics Squad, detailed the trip to New Jersey and back to North Charleston, South Carolina, alerting law enforcement that this was a trip to bring drugs back to South Carolina. Second, the two narcotics detectives assigned to perform the traffic stop, which was part of the plan to search the vehicle, were only on the scene because of the information provided by the tracking device. This minor traffic offense did not break the chain of causation between the illegal search and the incriminating evidence seized. These two detectives were not unconnected with the investigation, but an integral part of the plan to stop and search the vehicle. This is not an intervening circumstance, again, as explained in Sprinkle. It was not a separate and distinct crime of the defendant, who was not the driver of the Grand Prix, but a traffic offense, minor though it was, by the driver, that would not have been observed, without the information that was continuously provided, again, by the tracking device.
Let me ask you this. Can you think of an analogous situation to this one, perhaps in another search and seizure context, where the police take advantage, they conduct an illegal search, and they take advantage of information gained through the illegal search in order to find activity of another crime? Is anything that's similar to this situation that we could use as a guide
on
how to resolve this type of situation?
Yes. I don't think so. I think the illegal problem is the attaching of the GPS tracking device.
All right, and so that makes it an illegal search.
Yes, sir. And also, the search only occurred because of the location of the vehicle and the law enforcement narcotics.
This is an illegal search. They got the GPS on there. They're following him. That's an illegal search.
Yes, sir.
They're able to take advantage of the information from an illegal search to know exactly where he is.
Exactly. Yes, sir. But
and then
he didn't. He, the defendant.
They take advantage of the knowledge gained from the illegal search in order to find other criminal activity.
Well, the only criminal activity that occurred was the traffic violation.
Right.
Because
you give the turn signal. You're saying that they wouldn't have been behind him if they hadn't had the GPS on there.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's the reason they were following him.
Yes, sir. They set up on I-95 after the turnaround in New Jersey and followed down with different units coming in behind. Detective Roy had his laptop, making sure the GPS was still working, alerted the Detective Bailey and Hughes, had the drug dog sitting in the drug canine unit available, also to come up to the scene, and made the stop after the change of lane without the traffic signal.
What if I'm a police officer and I go into someone's home without a warrant, and I'm standing in their home and I've conducted an illegal search.
Yes, sir.
And I see marijuana on the table, drugs on the table in plain view. Is that analogous to the situation?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the drugs were certainly not in plain view. If I can be just very specific.
Well, I don't mean in this case, but I mean, I just use that as an example of obvious criminal activity. They could be anything. I mean, gun,
okay.
Whatever.
Well, I think obviously if it's evidence of a crime that the law enforcement officer knows about, or if it's a legal substance, or if the drugs is not, you cannot possess legally, I think they can be seized, even though they're in the home illegally.
I guess the difference would be in one place, you're in this particular case, you're in a place, police are in a place they got a right to be.
Yes, sir.
And going to someone's home, they're not in a place they got a right to be.
You could carry the argument that it was possibly a legal stop. And I think that's where the court was the district court was focusing on. But I don't see how it can be a legal stop when all you have, the only reason you are there, and the entire team is there is because for 27 days they monitored the motions of this vehicle. The only time they ever checked to see if it was okay was to check to be sure the GPS tracking device was working. There's no other evidence of illegal narcotic activity at all. There was historical information from two confidential sources, one North Charleston narcotics source, the other a DEA source. The DEA agent, Duffy, said his information was that the narcotics came from New Jersey. So once they put the GPS tracking device on the vehicle, his instructions were this: if the vehicle goes to New Jersey and makes a quick turnaround, we need to set up some way to make a traffic stop because that was a trip to pick up drugs. I mean, that's what
the court said. It was a legitimate traffic stop.
What if it was?
It was a legitimate traffic stop.
What if it was? I don't concede.
Well,
it
but
was
but the here was, they didn't give a turn signal.
That's correct.
So it was a legitimate stop.
Yes.
Well, in the law, it doesn't matter what the subjective intent of the officers are, if they have legitimate traffic violations to warrant the stop of the vehicle.
That's correct. But if we had just a traffic unit on the scene.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, that they wouldn't have been there but for the GPS.
Yes.
And they actually didn't find the drugs until after they'd gotten a search warrant, did they?
Well, they did find a packet of drugs under the mat on the passenger side, the same side Richard was sitting on. But it was the conclusion in the presentation in the trial was that was an old packet that had fallen there somewhere and nobody was even aware that it was there. But they did discover the possibility of a secret compartment with a hydraulic lift and all of that at the scene.
They didn't open that up until after they got the search warrant.
That's correct. And they used the search warrant information, and they used the GPS tracking information to support the search warrant. As I was saying, the law enforcement intent was to catch Richard with illegal drugs. To that end, they installed the tracking device on Richard's vehicle without a warrant in the hope that something such as a quick turnaround trip to New Jersey area would take place. It did. When it did, DEA agents in the North Charleston Narcotics Unit, the dog team, and possibly others set up as far west as I-95, all based upon the information provided again by the GPS tracking device. Detective Roy continued to monitor the travel of the vehicle even after visual surveillance occurred on 95 and 26. The vehicle was stopped, the driver was questioned, the dog was deployed, and the search of the scene resulted in the seizure of heroin. That was the one under the mat, not the seizure in the secret compartment.
Well, didn't the driver, Ms. Coney, didn't she give consent to search?
She did, Your Honor. She did. However,
that was a girlfriend, right?
Yes, sir.
The driver was a girlfriend?
Yes, sir.
And she consented to search the car?
She did.
So it was a legal stop, and then they had a consent search?
It was a legal stop with the driver giving consent to search, none of which would have happened
if they hadn't been there.
Get back to my theme.
You don't think
none of which would have happened
they'd have been there?
If we hadn't
had
the GPS.
Well, they might have stumbled onto it.
They wouldn't have been there.
You don't think it would have been?
No, sir. I'm pretty sure they would. That's my strong position. if the traffic violation were legitimate stop, and you could search after that, you wouldn't even need a warrant for the GPS. You could put a GPS on a vehicle until it made the traffic change, stop it.
Well, the traffic stop is legitimate stop unless there's clear error, right?
It's a legitimate stop.
Right, so it's a legitimate stop, and there was a consent and a search warrant.
And a search warrant later, yes, sir. But this is not a but-for situation. This is not but-for the GPS situation. This is a because of the GPS situation.
I understand.
All right. And I think the district court was correct when they said the exclusionary rule should apply and apply the exclusionary rule up to the time of the traffic.
Just said he didn't apply it far enough.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I say again today it didn't.
He agreed with you on part of it.
But he did. That's why I'm going along.
Didn't go far enough.
Didn't go far enough. No, sir. Did determine that there was no binding precedent in the Fourth Circuit, and Jones had not been decided on how to use the GPS, and so therefore the exclusionary rule based upon the binding precedent did not apply, and as the district court so found. The U.S. v. Knotts case from 1983 has been cited as a possible as binding precedent for purposes of this application of the GPS tracking device. However, when you read Jones, Jones points out all of the matters in Knox that were not the same. When you read the Knox decision, you see all of the warnings in there that this question wasn't raised. We didn't have a chance to address the attachment of the beeper to the vehicle and on. And it was a beeper. It didn't have anything. It didn't have any of the characteristics that the global positioning tracking device has today. It's our position that a warrant was required, and a warrant was not obtained under the facts of this case. It was a warrantless use of the GPS tracking device, one day shy of what Jones' tracking device was used. Jones was 28 days, this one was 27. In Jones, you had a great, long, and involved investigation with wiretaps and pen registers and surveillance to a nightclub, all of that, which I'm sure the court's aware of. And in this particular case, what you had was historical evidence, a GPS tracking device attached without a warrant, and just monitor it until something happened. And that's what occurred.
Thank you. I think you're out of time, but you've got some time reserved. Let's hear from Mr. Williams.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Dixon. Mr. Williams.
Morning, may it please the court. Counsel. My name is Nathan Williams. I'm an assistant United States attorney out of South Carolina. I'm in the Charleston office. The good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, because there was no flagrant police misconduct in this case, justifies the admission of the heroin or drug evidence. Judge Duffy considered... Go ahead.
You're leading with your best argument?
That's the best argument.
Well, Judge Duffy didn't use it, did he?
He didn't. He used the subsequent intervening...
You're giving him up?
Well, he was right. I don't know if that was his best argument. I think that argument works, but I believe that the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule is the strongest argument of the three that Judge Duffy considered, although he did not rule in favor of the good faith exception. He obviously, as the court has already discussed, went with the subsequent intervening illegality or the turn signal, but as Mr. Dixon has pointed out, there's a lot of case law that discusses attenuation and whether there's a new and distinct or an illegal act that severs the connection between the illegality or in this case, the illegal search and then the discovery of the evidence. So certainly the turn signal in this case arguably severs that activity, meaning the GPS was used, but the use of the turn signal and other things, the use of a drug dog to sniff the outside of the car, the nervousness of the individuals in the car, several other things I would argue are more of a totality of the circumstances situation gave the detectives indications that there was drug activity afoot, which they then obtained a search warrant to find most of the evidence in the case. So that argument is certainly there, and it's a valid one. However, it is not exactly the same as what you saw in Sprinkle or you saw in Bailey, where you had officers that were going to conduct a frisk or were pursuing an individual, and then all of a sudden a gun gets pulled and somebody gets shot at. The attenuation between tracking somebody on foot, like you had in Sprinkle or in Bailey, and then a gun being pulled or a gun falling are very different. In this case, we had a higher degree of attenuation. Mr. Dixon has mentioned the GPS tracker being used to identify where the vehicle was located. I think there was actually a little bit more to it than that. I think the testimony in the case indicated that the officers were using the GPS tracker to determine when the defendant was going to his source of supply in New Jersey to pick up heroin. So
was this car actually returning from New Jersey?
It was. So the GPS tracker had been installed, and essentially the car had been stationary for weeks. I think there was one instance where the car moved, They went to a local laundromat. They saw the defendant with the car. But the information provided by two separate identified sources was that the defendant's source of heroin supply was in the Northeast, and they thought New Jersey. So the GPS tracker was applied to do what the officers would ordinarily do without that technology, which was determine when the vehicle was going to leave the area to connect with its source. And so when the tracker indicated that the car was going to New Jersey, they observed it further, saw a quick turnaround time, and then the car came back to South Carolina. They set up on the side of the road and made the traffic stop, which involved the lack of a use of a turn signal, which is a traffic violation.
You agree that was a pretextual stop?
Yes. And I would say that the testimony in the case explained the pretext. Officers, first of all, weren't entirely certain that there was going to be drugs in the car. So when they conducted the initial search, what they didn't want to do was to disclose the existence of the investigation if there weren't going to be drugs inside. So the pretext of the traffic stop, first of all, would be for officer safety, so that they wouldn't alert the driver and passenger that they were there for the drugs. And second of all, to give an opportunity to ascertain whether there was drugs in the car. So I would suggest to your honors that the testimony was, if there had not been a positive drug kit by the dog on the car, they probably would have just gone back and waited for another opportunity to find evidence. So that's not to say that there wasn't a crime committed or a traffic offense, but certainly it was a pretext. They were not, I would say, by any real measure
pretty
out there.
Pretty marginal traffic offense, isn't it?
Right, and as I said,
what percentage of people give a turn signal for an interstate exit?
Yeah, and I agree. I think it is a fairly marginal traffic offense. I don't think the officers in the case were, by any testimony, investigating traffic offenses. They were using that as a pretext, first of all, to not alert the passengers to their investigation, and second of all, to not disclose their investigation should there not be drug evidence. So having said that, Sprinkle and Bailey and you know, a lot of cases talk about that still as a valid subsequent intervening illegality. Unfortunately, I believe that those cases are less attenuated between the illegal activity or the illegal search and then the subsequent evidence which is recovered. So it certainly works. It's just not as, I would say it's not as strong as what was seen in Sprinkle and what was seen in Bailey. On the other hand, Davis specifically and other cases that deal with the good faith exception talk about and focus on the flagrancy of police misconduct. And that really at the heart of this case.
But the good faith thing rises out of warrant, right? Insufficient warrant.
It arises out of insufficient searches. So certainly where you don't have a warrant or where there's illegal activity or illegal searches that are conducted. Jones made it clear, granted, a long time after these facts happened. And this case actually happened before Maynard. So even D.C. hadn't said that, the D.C. Circuit hadn't said that the use of the GPS device was a search. So at the time this occurred, the officers were doing what officers across the country were doing, what was sort of the recognized information that came out of Knott's, which was that you could use a GPS in public spaces. So they were doing what we would want law enforcement to do. There was certainly no flagrant misconduct. And Davis talks about that, the question of, and I think it's Justice Alito talked about whether there was flagrant misconduct underlying the illegal search. And certainly at that time, there was no binding circuit court precedent. I would suggest that even now, there's not a whole lot of direction from any of the circuits as to non-binding circuit precedent and the good faith exception. There's a lot of district court opinions, but right now, I don't believe there's a whole lot of guidance as to the situation where you have non-binding, non-circuit court precedent that agents or officers rely on to conduct a search, especially using a GPS. So at the bottom of this case, I believe what you see is officers doing what we would expect them to do, trying to follow the rules as best they could. I believe at the time Jones came out, there was a news report on it, I think about 3,000 GPSs were taken down by the FBI. I know that cases that I was working on when Jones came out, GPSs that were attached were shut down. Across the country, reliance on the use of GPS on Knotts, on Caro, and prior precedent was in good faith relied upon. So to sanction the officers in this case, I think is contrary to what Davis talks about with the good faith exception, where officers rely on earlier case precedent and then act accordingly.
Have any other circuits used the good faith exception in these circumstances?
No, and that's why I say there's not a whole lot of, at least in the GPS context, there's a lot of districts that have gone in both directions. But as far as circuits, I don't believe any have ruled on it yet. And it's a very, I don't want to say a new issue, but certainly there's no precedent on that issue. And there's certainly a split among the different districts as to which direction that would go, meaning do you need a specific binding precedent in your circuit in order to rely on, or can you rely on non-binding, non-circuit precedents such as Knotts or Caro, which were outside the Fourth Circuit?
And Judge Duffy specifically ruled that it didn't apply.
He did, and that's why I disagree with him on that point. But I also think he had a different reason that he followed. And in other districts, and I believe that a case out of the Fourth Circuit, one of the judges here, and I think it was in Maryland or Virginia, had ruled opposite, that he thought the good faith exception did apply to the use of a GPS. I think it was in Batista. Batista was the name of the case. So that there certainly has been a lot of discussion and a lot of district court activity in both directions, but they all analyze that same issue, which is the use of non-binding, non-circuit court precedent for good faith. So I think that is the strongest argument. I think the intervening illegal turn is also a justification for the stop, and Judge Duffy was right on that ruling. And finally,
you're not giving him up on the Sprinkle case?
No, I can't, I guess. I don't know. I guess that's up to y'all to decide on how that follows through. But I do think that Sprinkle fits, and you have an intervening illegality. It's just not the type we've seen in Sprinkle or we've seen in Bailey, which were similar cases. And the final argument I think that applies is whether, and the Supreme Court left this open in Jones, whether reasonable suspicion or probable cause would justify the search given an automobile exception. And I think they specifically left that open and said that the government did not argue in Jones that the search was supported by reasonable suspicion or probable cause. And I would suggest in this case there was certainly, and I know Judge Duffy didn't find probable cause or reasonable suspicion, but I think when you analyze the facts of the case, having two individuals or informants stating that they knew this individual used this specific car, that they identified the car and identified him as well as where he obtained his drugs from, his source, and then the travel to that area and back, certainly I think the defendant just driving that car on the freeway coming from the north would have been probable cause or reasonable suspicion to conduct the stop. And once the stop is made, you know, the case becomes much better, meaning once the dog does the free air sniff and hits on the car, there's reason to get inside the car, the drugs are found, and a search warrant's obtained.
Is all that reasonable suspicion and probable cause, all that in the record?
Yes, it was. You know, there were two trials in the case. The first trial was pre-Jones. That first trial included all of the GPS evidence. Judge Duffy then suppressed that evidence, and we proceeded to a second trial. He ordered a new trial without the evidence. We proceeded with simply the evidence of the traffic stop, but none of the evidence regarding the use of the GPS, either substantively or as reason to be on the side of the road to conduct the stop or why.
Did you try both cases?
Yes, I did. The second one was a quicker verdict for some reason with less evidence. But so it certainly was brought up at the first trial. It was brought up in motions, and it's in the record that the two cooperating sources described the location. And for that matter, the girl that was inside the car, Ms. Coney, testified that this was at trial both times, that they drove up to New Jersey. She thought they were going there to go on a trip and do some shopping. The defendant did some things that she couldn't understand, got out of his car, got back in, and they came straight back to South Carolina. So she also gave a fairly clear account of what looked like a drug pickup or a transaction up in New Jersey. So I believe under all three of the theories that were presented to the district court, meaning the subsequent intervening illegality, reasonable suspicion, or probable cause, as well as finally the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, under all three of those theories, the court could have found this evidence admissible. The judge focused on one of those. I think Sprinkle applies and Bailey as well. But at the end, I believe the lack of flagrant misconduct by the officers is what is clearest. They were doing what should have been expected of officers in that situation, and Davis talks about flagrant misconduct, and that certainly was not present here. So for those reasons, I would submit to your honors that the evidence should be admitted and Judge Duffy should be sustained.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Dixon?
Yes, sir.
The government's made your job a little bit easier.
Yes, sir.
Think about everything that's been said that could be said in this case, and I'm a little reluctant to go forward much further. You're very well aware of Mr. Rich's position, which I am trying to articulate. I am firmly convinced that the warrantless use of the GPS tracking device for 27 days, which also gave the law enforcement officers on the scene when questioning Richard after he was removed from the car about the details of the trip to New Jersey, and Richard said something about they'd been there 2 or 3 days, and the GPS tracking device, which all of the narcotics agents were aware of, was that there had been a direct trip to New Jersey. He was in Newark, New Jersey for about an hour and a half, and then a direct trip back to South Carolina. The exact type of a trip that the DEA agent, Special Agent Duffy, had explained would be a trip to pick up narcotics. I have nothing else I can add, unless there are some particular questions.
Fine. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Dixon, I note you're court appointed. We appreciate very much your undertaking representation of this client. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our next case.